before we start again, have you seen the video of Henry Cavill building a gaming computer?
I have not. Is it adorable?
I'm just saying, it turns out there is actually still a lingering thread of my heterosexuality in existence. Pratchett World Cup, quarterfinals.
Quarterfinals, baby. So let's have a look. Did you already...
I've already voted.
You did? Okay. Okay.
Using the podcast Twitter account.
Oh, what's their name?
At Hamard 1980 underscore 1987.
There they are. Right. Good Omens versus Small Gods. Ooh. Witches Abroad versus Nightwatch. I love Witches Abroad, but it's got to be Nightwatch, isn't it? Yeah.
I think everyone was
very
right
unfair Nightwatch on Witches Abroad.
Nightwatch is very much going to win.
Truth versus Going Postal.
You have got to vote the truth, because I've been tweeting at all of our listeners trying to get our namesake to win.
Obviously I will vote the truth, but yeah, as I suspected, Going Postal's winning.
I know, I'm not happy about it. So by the time this goes out, I think the final will have already happened, and I don't think the truth is going to get past the quarterfinal, but I'm upset that we couldn't get our namesake that bit further.
Well, whichever way it goes, it's going to be less depressing than the time we recorded just before the election.
God.
At least none of the options is Boris Johnson, put it that way.
Bloody stupid Johnson.
Yeah. Men at Arms versus Hogfather. Men at Arms.
Obviously. Although Hogfather is very good.
It is very good. I just really like
Men at Arms. Men at Arms, yeah.
Yeah. Good Omens, Small Gods. Good Omens.
That one is tight.
That's a close one. Yeah.
That's I do love Small Gods and a bit of, you know, interrogating the human condition and its relationship to faith. But
I love that.
It would be really nice if one Discworld did make it through. One non-Discworld, even.
So, be the psychic octopus we get every World Cup. who do you think's going to win?
Oh, it's going to be Nightwatch, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be Nightwatch. All right. You know, I would like our listeners... Octopus. That's a lovely octopus impression.
Yes, I would like our listeners to know that I'm very into this right now. I've just grown six extra arms.
If I remember, I'll turn you into a GIF.
Darling, I got better.
Help, I'm being compressed.
It's a year since we started making this.
Is it?
It's not a year since we started releasing it, because we didn't start releasing it till October, because we recorded The Colour of Magic and then my life went wrong. But
yes,
it is a year since we started working on it.
Good grief. What have we learned in the year? We've learned very little, unfortunately.
No, but the sound quality is better than it was on the early episodes.
Yeah, and it's still not have a great, but
structure. Hey, we didn't build this blanket fort for nothing.
So, without too much further ado,
do you want to make a podcast?
Let's make a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Two Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book in Sir Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time, in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen-Young.
I'm Francine Carroll. Why did you give him his title this time?
I don't know. I
mean, not that he doesn't deserve it. It's just suddenly you've gained an extra inch of respect for the great man.
We did the interview the other day, and I'm thinking about him as Sir Terry a bit more.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, listeners, you get bonus content next week, and good bonus content, not just us sitting down and going, go right then, run out.
I'm Joanna Hagen-Young.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part three of our discussion of Guards, Guards!
Guards, Guards!
The eighth Discworld novel. This is a spoiler-light podcast, obviously heavy spoilers for the book we're on. Guards, Guards! But we will avoid spoiling major future events in the Discworld series, and we are saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld book, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us. Francine, anyway,
yes.
Would you like to tell me what happened last time in Guards, Guards?
Guards, Guards! Previously on. Ankh Morpork has a case of the dragons, and the traditional cure is a hero. Unfortunately, the patrician isn't willing to give up half the non-existent kingdom and the hand of a non-existent daughter, so the cream of the barbarian crop aren't interested. The dragon continues its reign of moderate terror, flaming the watch house and vanishing again. The Elucidated Brethren start to fret about their reptilian charge, but it's too late to turn back, and the Brethren's nominated hero takes up arms to slay the dragon. After a remarkably tidy fight, a newly dragonless and brethrenless Ankh Morpork crowns its new king and has an unfortunate fling with Bunting before it becomes clear that the monster's disappearance wasn't as permanent as they'd hoped.
Dun dun da!
Exactly. Now, see, I think I've got a bit confused about the order of when the Brethren got flamed, but I didn't go back and check, so.
That's absolutely fine.
Cool, cool.
My summary for last week was very confusing because it was a bit action-packed.
Yeah.
Whew. So this time.
Yes.
On guards, guards. We begin with the lads from the watch on the Temple of Small God's roof awaiting some dragonfire. They realize they may have in fact found the dragon because they're sitting on it. The dragon unfolds, scaring the shit out of them as below in the city, the coronation continues. A fired Vimes plans on fury as Errol eats everything and distant cheering turns to screams. A self-satisfied dragon basks in the remains of the collapsed coronation as a small child celebrates and the crowd cries off.
Nice alliteration.
Mate, very I was on a good. Roll. It went very quickly. Vimes and Sybil watch as the dragon claims the crown and the city and once. The citizens of Ankh Morpork continue to celebrate, even if they're unsure what they're celebrating. At the newly renovated palace, the civic leaders are fed well by a nervous once who informs them that some sacrifices must be made. We get an insight into the link between once and the dragon. The palace guard asks what's left of the watch to share the news that the dragon has a very, very specific diet. Vimes takes a poorly Errol to everyone's favourite dragon breeder, Sybil. Things take an awkward turn when Vimes walks away. Colon almost starts a protest before being rudely awakened by the dragon. The plucky band of watchmen agree on a plan of archery, vulnerables, and a slim chance. Vimes confronts Supreme Grandmaster once, who attempts to shift the blame onto Vetinari for his dastardly dragon summoning. Vimes is having none of it and is swiftly incarcerated with the ex-ruler of the city. Lady Sybil is summoned to the palace to provide dinner for the dragon as Vimes enjoys a light lunch with Vetinari in a remarkably comfortable prison cell. Colon tests his archery skills as Vimes starts tenaciously chipping at the cell door. The librarian arrives to hurry along Vimes' escape. Vimes learns about the virginal conditions of the dragon's rule and attempts a feat of heroism. Colon shoots and misses. The dragon flames and doesn't. Vimes almost rescues Sybil as the dragon arrives for dinner, and we learn that the watchmen have miraculously survived the dragon's flame. Vetinari lets himself out of prison, having preserved Vimes' worldview. Sybil's dragon kennels explode as Errol takes the sky to face the dragon. As Errol flies away, the king dragon crashes. Carrot arrests the downed dragon, but as Errol returns with amorous intent, the queen dragon takes off again. Vimes makes it to the palace as Vetinari faces off against a running once. Carrot takes Throw the Book far too literally, and once meets his end with murder by metaphor. Back in his place ruling the city, Vetinari rewards Vimes in the watch. Vimes visits Sybil for dinner and comes to a conclusion. Carrot and the lads head to the pub, and we end on the turtle.
I like it. That was a very good summary.
Thank you. I had fun with alliteration. I don't know why, but it felt very alliterative when I wrote this yesterday.
Some days just take you that way, don't they? Yeah, I'm the same. It's a mood that I'm not sure everybody relates to, but probably a lot of our listeners do. I like to think
you're
an alliterative bunch as ever you're going to meet.
our
darling little listeners on their dear
little legs. Helicopter and loincloth watch for this book. Dragons count as helicopters, so plenty. Yep.
Two.
Hepticopters.
I forgot to do it. You knew I would.
In the notes.
Are we really going to call Errol a hepticopter, even though he's clearly a jet engine? We have one hepticopter and one jet engine.
Fine. Errol can be a jet engine.
Yeah.
Neither of them were wearing loincloths.
No, as far as we know. If they were, Terry Pratchett did not feel it necessary to say so.
He did not describe the loincloth. Shall I go first with a quote then?
Yeah. Yeah. Yours is first. Quite a way first. That's right near the beginning. Ooh.
Well, I considered reading out basically the entire back end of the book, and I'm probably going to when we get to that.
Honestly, that would be fine if that wasn't a copyright thing. I'd be happy just to mute myself and let you read me a book today.
Story time.
We need to get you back doing voiceovers.
Yeah, if anyone wants to hire me, I'll buy a better mic. and build a better blanket fort.
I can afford thicker blankets, better blankets, some kind more of scaffolding.
As opposed to a laundry error in a very precariously balanced chair that nearly collapsed during our last recording. This is from fairly early on when they're deciding whether or not to protest the dragon. Oh, no, it's when the dragon's flying up towards the coronation. It's earlier than I thought. The dragon flew slowly, only a few feet above the ground, wings sculling gracefully through the air. The flags that crisscrossed the street were caught up and snapped like so much cobweb, piling up on the creature's spine plates and flapping back along the length of its tail. It flew with head and neck fully extended, as if the great body was being towed like a barge. The people on the street yelled and fought one another for the safety of doorways, and it paid them no attention. It should have come roaring, but the only sounds were the creaking of wings and the snapping of banners. It should have come roaring. Not like this. Not slowly and deliberately, giving terror time to mature. It should have come threatening, not promising. It should have come roaring, not flying gently to the accompaniment of the zip and zing of merry bunting.
Ooh.
Isn't that good?
It is good, yeah. That's, I would have picked that if you hadn't. That's such a good...
I really like the contrast. Well, I like the change in... And I'll talk a bit more about the dragon later, but I like the change in now the dragon is on its own agenda and not someone else's. It is... Mm. intelligent enough to deliberately terrify. Also, yeah. I like bunting getting fucked up because, you know, we had my little bunting rant last week.
That applies to our personal preferences. Just the idea of the silent destructive menace from the skies is somehow more intimidating.
I also like the way it uses the repeat in there where it repeats that it should have come roaring over and over again, because it's almost like someone who can't quite process something. So they're just sort of saying the same thing over and over again because they're so terrified.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's a really beautiful, it's almost poetic.
Mm-hmm. Well done, Terry Pratchett. Very nice dragonfly.
You know what? I think he's quite a good writer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you wouldn't be entirely alone in that opinion.
Yeah. No. You're right. Don't mind a bit, Terry Pratchett. Right, sorry, what's your quote, Francine?
I'm not bloody well going to have it, understand? Vime shouted, shaking the ape back and forth. Ook, the librarian pointed out patiently. What? Oh, sorry. Vimes lowered the ape, who wisely didn't make an issue of it, because a man angry enough to lift 300 pounds of orangutan without noticing it is a man with too much on his mind.
That's a marvellous moment. Anyway, characters.
Yeah.
This isn't a major character, but it makes me so happy. The coronation has just been completely trashed. There's a massive, satisfied dragon sitting around. He's just sort of about to bugger off to the palace, and everyone's running and screaming and scared. And there's a small child, by Vimes' side, a small child waved a flag hesitantly and shouted, "Hurrah!" And the child just stands there chatting to Vimes, going, "Oh, my auntie said if I was naughty, she put me on the roof and called the dragon. My auntie says it eats you all up, starting with the legs." And there's another moment a little bit later on where the child sort of goes, "Can I wave my flag now?" And Vimes says, "Yeah, fine, whatever." And the child's like, "Hurrah." But it's all the fact that it's hurrah with no exclamation point. It's a very nonchalant hurrah.
Yeah, I know I am here. I am meant to wave a flag and say hurrah.
Yeah.
This I know.
Hurrah. It is exactly what I could see my little baby nephew doing. He would also be very excited about getting eaten by a dragon. Yes.
Now, we don't actually meet the Duke of Stowhelet, so I imagine you've put in there because you're terribly clever that you noticed the reference.
Yes, I just want everyone to know how clever I am. And no, it made me smile. I like I said, that he's nodding back to his previous books. It's Sybil offering to help Vimes get a new job. And he's like, "Oh, the Duke of Stowhelet's looking for a guard captain. I'll write you a letter. You'll like them. They're a very nice young couple."
Yeah.
And this is obviously Mort, Duke of Stowhelet, and his new wife, Isabel.
Yay.
They are indeed a lovely young couple. So on to one of the bigger ones. We haven't really talked about Once a Lot since he got introduced in the first section.
We haven't. Because there wasn't really any way to do so without doing a spoiler. Yeah.
So now we know that he's the one that's been summoning the dragon, and the dragon's used him to get back. Da, da, da. On page 221 in my copy, as he's serving lunch to the civic leaders,
yeah,
there's a line, his voice sounded one dribble away from madness. And he really reminds me of the Duke from Weird Sisters. It's the same thing of like, he is desperately clinging to this cold sanity in what is incredibly ridiculous. And he is so close to losing it.
Yeah.
He effectively asked the leader of the Assassin's Guild to kill him.
Yeah.
Because he's absolutely stuck in this situation, but he goes full politician.
Yes. It's like when you've had like a shit day or week or whatever, and you've just got to go to work and like,
you just have to keep going through it.
Overlay of I'm fine. I can do this for a couple of hours, except like dragon.
Yeah. Except there is literally a dragon, and he keeps talking and he's sort of yes, this will be fine. And we'll do this like this. And of course you'll contribute to the horde and it'll be a civic levy tax. And you guys will be you'll be the privy councillors and you'll be richly rewarded. And of course there is the matter of the king's diet.
Yes.
And he only ever refers to the dragon as the king. There's a really good line. The head assassin said later he'd looked into the eyes of many men who obviously were very near death. But he never looked into eyes that were so clearly and unmistakably looking back at him from the slopes of hell. And it's this way that once has already resigned himself to absolute misery and hell.
Yeah.
And he is still just very brittly saying, yes, no, and of course, you know, you're all the Privy Council now. And yes, of course, we will have to sacrifice a virgin, but it's fine, you know, in the grandest old tradition of healthy ties. Which leads me very nicely to the dragon, who, again, we haven't really talked about as a character because it's just been this anonymous threat for the last two sections, and it gets to be an actual character here. You
hear it
speaking.
Yeah.
And just as once is very determinedly trying to make virgin sacrifice seem very normal to this.
Yeah, doing his PR job.
Yeah. The dragon is appalled that this is so easy.
Yeah. Yeah, and like the dragon wants to, but thinks it would be the correct thing if he had to come in and be, you know, enforce tyranny rather than
exactly
spin it like, nicely.
And he's so appalled that once has basically gone, yeah, no, I can make it think it's all their idea. It's the line where he says, there'll be no mighty warrior sent to kill me, it thought almost plaintively.
Yeah. It doesn't know how it's meant to go.
Yeah. And it is. It's this interruption to narrative causality.
Yeah.
That is what Pratchett does so well when he's doing these sorts of parodies. But in this situation, it forces the dragon to then interrogate humanity, which I don't think it would have had to do much before because of what its life is. And he's furious at once. He says, you've got the effrontery to be squeamish. We're cruel. We're meant to be cruel and heartless and terrible. But it's such a beautiful line. We never burned and tortured and ripped one another apart and called it morality.
Yeah.
Like, this is a comedy fantasy parody book. That line alone. One last little silly character moment before I go on to revisiting some of our big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Vimes goes to Sybil's near the end of the book and meets these ladies because they were far too untidy to be mere women. No ordinary woman would have dreamed of looking so scruffy. And it's the thing Pratchett goes back to a lot with the poshos of the can afford things that last and will quite happily stomp around in their grandparents' Wellington boots.
Yeah.
Their silk scarves, old tweed coats and granddad's riding boots. And there's something about them that really makes me giggle because there was this woman back, like I talked a lot about the fact that the dragon people are a lot like the horsey people I used to know.
Sure.
And there was this one amazing woman that used to come to the races. She was part of our like owner's syndicate for that one horse that my parents had shares in.
Mm-hmm.
And her name was John. She only answered to John. She was about 5 foot tall, dressed exactly like this at all times, mad as a box of frogs, ridiculously posh. Like, bear in mind, I would have been like 8 at the time, and she'd always take the time to, like, we bought big fans for one of the race days at Brighton because we thought, oh, we're going to be in the owner's enclosure, let's be ladies with fans.
Yeah.
And she would quite happily, in the middle of the owner's enclosure at Brighton Racecourse, get into a sword fight with our fans and stuff. It's absolutely just like these women. So it really did make me smile because it gave me a proper nostalgia.
Oh, good. Vimes.
Yeah, I wanted to keep doing this, checking back in with the big characters.
Mm-hmm.
And Vimes and his anger, the big sort of theme that we're checking in on. And there is an amazing moment where he realizes that his job, because he's dealing with the fact that he once effectively fired him.
Yeah.
And he's facing off against once before he gets put in prison.
Yeah.
And he's insisting, well, you can't take my job. You can't give me my job back. You couldn't have taken my job because I'm an officer of the law and it's the law I uphold above all else. And it's a theme that's more there in things that are said than things that are done, because like we talked last week about the fact that actually Vimes encourages some pretty bad policing.
Yeah.
But it becomes a theme as we go through the books, like Vimes really upholds the law and it means so much to him. And he's just, he's appalled by it. He's furious because there is no law when the ruler of the city is a dragon.
Yeah.
And you get his anger again as well later on when he thinks that when the distillery that the watch were on has been blown up and he thinks that they've died. And he's so furious because he just thinks, well, that wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
You know, they've died for nothing. They earned $30 a month. His anger is such a, almost a superpower for him. And the fact that he is so furious about that, but he keeps going and he's still trying to rescue Sybil, even as he's, and it is, it's fury and anger. He's not sad about the fact that these people have died as much as he is absolutely furious that they've died for no reason.
Yeah. I just feel like he's never going to accept it being fair or noble when it's one of his men or women eventually who dies.
Yeah.
I think part of what makes him him is that he is always going to rage against
the machine.
The machine, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I get the only $30 a month thing as well, but like, yeah, I feel like whatever it was, he would have been angry. That's just how he managed to word it in his head at the time. Yeah.
I'm really just fascinated by how his like explosive frustration almost propels him through a story.
Yeah, when he sees, eventually when he comes out as hysterical laughter when the dragon goes into the palace.
Yeah, yeah, and he's like, oh yeah, fuck it, why not? Crown a fucking dragon.
Okay, great, we've already got the bunting up. Fucking great, yeah. Yeah. Dragon King.
I have reacted like that to things a lot, especially in the last week. But it's when he sees that the poster basically saying that a highborn virgin has to be fed to the dragon.
Yeah.
And his response is, in my city.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has this, he still has this possessiveness over Ankh Morpork.
Yeah. Which serves him well.
It does. Life. It does.
But at the moment is not great because he's impotent at that moment.
Mm. From Vimes that's run to Sybil, mm-hmm. and again another theme I want to keep checking in on, which is how her fatness is treated. And this actually kind of links in with how the dragon is treated as well. I've quoted this book before, but I think this one is particularly relevant, and this is the Tansy Rayner Roberts book, Pratchett's Women.
Really read this.
Which is like I said, I mentioned it on the podcast before. It's a series of essays about Pratchett's female characters, and this is on Sybil Rankin. Guards, the first book featuring the City Watch, is pretty light when it comes to female characters. The most central woman in the whole story is Sybil Ramkin, dragon expert. She emerges as a fascinating, fully realised and complicated female character despite every attempt of the narrative. Each time she appears, she has to wade through a sea of fat jokes, posh lady jokes, lonely spinster jokes, and in some cases all three at once. More than once, she is described vividly as something monstrous or other than human, including scenes from the point of view of Sam.
Yeah. Of the romantic interest, I think you can put it.
Yes, there is obviously romantic interest. And there is when they come to the doorstep to drag her out, and admittedly she's just shoved a wig and some very strong perfume on in the dark and is wearing leather gauntlets.
Yeah.
But she's described as this monster. He genuinely thinks it's some kind of monster and makes this, you know, sign against devils.
Yeah.
And he's sort of having to remind himself, no, it's fine. She is human. I mean, I love this scene because she's fucking badass and tries to go at them with a broadsword.
Yeah. How is it described exactly? Hold on. What page is it?
251. The thing was still there, bristling with rage, reeking of something sickly and fermented, crowned with a skewed mass of curls still looming behind a quivering bosom. Harpies, they were called. What had it done with Lady Ramkin?
That's not Vimes.
No, that one's not Vimes. Yeah. That's just an example of the way she's literally described as monstrous. But I find the fatness interesting when you then apply it to the way the dragon is suddenly treated when they find out it's a woman and that Errol's interest is actually romantic. They stop interrogating the dragon as evil or not evil. Like, the dragon itself has said to once, we are cruel.
Yeah.
We are, that's what we are as dragons. The moment it's a woman, it's like, oh yeah. And it's already been arrested at this point.
Yeah.
And fucking love that Carrot arrests the dragon. That's genius. But the moment it's a woman, oh yeah, let it fly off and have babies with little Errol. And, Rumpkin, you know, Nobby's slow on the upcake, and eventually she says, it's a girl. And Nobby says, but it's sodding enormous. And then he looks at Sybil and then he goes,
yeah, that oh, was I mean, the yeah, one that
fine figure of a dragon.
Raised my flag.
Yeah.
The Harpy one, I don't know about. That didn't set off my alarms in the same way, because I don't know if that is connected to fat particularly.
Yeah, it may not be fatness. It may be description in general, but I do think she has, I think that quote from the Tansy Rayner Roberts essay has a point. She is
often described as not human. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
As part of a trend, it's definitely worth noting. On its own, that didn't flag up for me like the other ones did. Yeah.
Yeah, if I hadn't been looking for it that particular, especially because that, you know, it's the point of the scene, is that part of the reason she's monstrous is grabbing a wig in the dark and putting on this perfume.
I think in that one I just imagine myself getting dressed in the dark and coming out as a harpy, but
it doesn't take me getting dressed in the dark to come out as a harpy. At least she didn't have a dragon under her arm.
What? Cool.
There's also, like, just talking, still on Sybil and fatness, the final moments of the book where she basically invites Vimes over to sort of hit on him.
Yeah.
And love that she did that. Love that journey for her. I might have watched a couple of episodes of Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
And Vimes sort of looks at her, and the way he thinks of her, like, this is, if I thought a man had gone through this thought process.
Yeah, that was the other bit that made me go, oh, possible.
It struck Vimes that in her own special category, she was quite beautiful. And this was the category of all the women in his entire life who ever thought he was worth smiling at.
Yeah.
She couldn't do worse, but then he couldn't do better.
I think this is Pratchett writing what he imagines to be a purely grown-up practical romance.
And it's good. I don't know about good.
Again, outside of the context of the trend of the descriptions, I would have taken it differently.
Yeah, but when you look at the trend of the descriptions, because it goes on to a brilliant thing, Vimes having been brung low by the city that is a woman, he realises that the woman was a city. And under siege, he did what Ankh-Morpork would have always done, which was unbar the gates, let the conquerors in and make them your own.
Yeah.
And then also the fact that it uses the here's looking at you kid line is, I get that it's another one of those movie references, but it's cringy.
Yeah, I'm not sure it really fit either.
It's so, so in the last section, when he comes out with a dragon under his arm and you have that whole Dirty Harry moment, it works and it's really Vimes.
Yeah.
But kid doesn't.
No. No, maybe if he'd been referring to, I don't know fucking anyone.
If he'd been referring to, if there'd been Nobby. A baby goat. If there had been a baby goat somewhere in that, it would have made it work.
Yeah. No, it's weird because
I love the relationship between them.
That's it. It's just such a weird, calculated introduction to it when I really like how they interact.
When you look at that moment of, like, not that much earlier, where he's dropped Errol off to her and walked away, and they're both sort of think, where she goes back inside and he's thinking, oh, I'll look back and she'll be standing there. And, you know, that simmering attraction between them is already there. It doesn't need him being very practically. It's like, oh, she's a munter, but I like her anyway. One other note on Sybil that was nothing to do with fatness, though, which is such a great moment. And this is when the dragon is kind of downed after its fight with Errol, and Carrot ends up arresting it. But everyone's going to attack it with swords and spears. They're really rare. And Sybil is so compassionate, she doesn't want them to kill the dragon like this.
Yeah.
And Vimes
just is about to eat you.
And yet Vimes thought it was just about to eat it and she can still think like this. Perhaps that did give you the right to an opinion. And this is the thing, Vimes has high standards for the people he is around.
Yeah.
And he knows... Low expectations, but very high standards.
Low expectations, like it.
And so this moment where he looks at Sybil and sees the compassion in her, and that's such a great thing about her character.
Mm.
I just really enjoyed that moment. Also, just the very cute little moment near the beginning of the section where he's looking at the coronation and she turns up. You know, every time we meet, a dragon appears. It's almost like having a song.
Yeah, I like that.
And this is what I love about Sybil. It's her confidence. You know, she's into this guy and she does kind of, she flirts with him and she goes for it. And again, the book doesn't let her just be brilliant and sexy and also fat. The book kind of adds some monstrosity and some other people sniggering at it. And I think some of that is very much the time it's written.
That quote from that book and what you've just said, like, the book doesn't let it, like, she is in the book. Like, I don't quite get it. Like, she's not an entity outside the book. Pratchett did write her. He wrote her to be this great character. Like, it's not her working against Pratchett here.
No, I know. I think what I mean is that Pratchett somehow just did a really good and really bad job at the same time, and it's almost like he wrote this really well-rounded character but then couldn't just let it be a bit mean to her. And the thing is, you've got other fat characters that sort of don't get the same, like, if you look at Nanny Ogg, and I know we've only had her in Weird Sisters, but she's not really described as monstrous, and she is described as bigger.
I think every character gets the piss taken out of them.
I think
with Sybil, literally, there was nothing to take the piss out of apart from her looks.
Yeah.
And that sucks because, like, it's not worth taking the piss out of.
Yeah.
That's saying, if this is the characteristic we're going to mock, then that's a characteristic worth mocking, like Vimes' anger and alcoholism, or Nanny Ogg's happiness and alcoholism.
I think if this book was written, I don't know when the Vicar of Dibley came out, but like 5 years later, but to use the Vicar of Dibley is a fat woman in a leading role, and her fatness is never brought up, and she is very, very much in control of her own sexuality.
Yeah,
I know. I'm talking
French
about
did a lot for.
Oh fuck! I love Dawn French. I know. I know it's a Richard Curtis sitcom, and it ain't that deep, but if you then look at how, like, Sybil gets treated in other books, I think even then, like, the monstrousness of her fatness goes away very quickly, which is why I point it up here.
Yeah, I think Pratchett, while he does have a lot of clever, subtle jokes in here, he also has a lot of blunt, bam, bam, reference joke, which I feel like he drops in later books and just has the clever humor, like, he has the silly wordplay, but he doesn't do the, like, here's looking at you kid type reference.
Yeah,
he unless it's clever like a... references and
yeah.
And I think probably along with that, a lot of the more obviously objectification stuff disappears.
Yeah. But I like pointing it up here because I know that it will be improved on, and also because I like pointing up when fatness is described as monstrous, so we can all know not to do that ourselves.
Yes, that should not be quietly accepted, quite right.
So on to Vetinari, and his intelligence. This is, we mentioned this briefly in one of the other episodes, but it's really fascinating to read such an intelligent character because that means the author is that intelligent.
Yeah.
And when Vetinari is in his prison cell, but has managed to make it so all the, you know, the bolts are on the inside and he can get out whenever he wants, and what he's done is actually lock the terrifying world away.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's trained the rats and helped them unionize against the snakes and the scorpions and created this miniature city. And there's this great line of Vimes thinking again, he wondered what it was like in the patrician's mind, all cold and shiny, he thought, all blue steel and icicles and little wheels clicking along like a huge clock.
Yeah.
And I just think reading how Vetinari is written and how clever he is makes me think of Terry Pratchett's mind like that.
Yes. However, I feel like how Vetinari chose to spend his time in there doesn't quite line up with the, like, clean, shiny clock thing, does it? It's like I feel like there's a little bit of another character we'll meet, Leonard of Querm, at some point.
Yeah. I think the
mad creativity within the
shiny icicles.
Yeah.
But I think it's that when he's thinking that about Vettinari, it's more to do with the fact that he's built this cell a certain way. It's not about his playing.
Yeah, that's true. That's just being 10 steps ahead of what could possibly happen at all times. Yeah.
I can barely think one step ahead. I'm usually about 8 steps behind and also going in the wrong direction.
I tripped over my feet.
Oh, again.
Yes, we'll talk more about Vettinari in a bit. Carrot's kingliness.
Oh, yes, Carrot and his kingliness. These are a couple of fun little references. So Carrot obviously has come to Ankh Morpork with a very sharp sword that manages to stop another sword very much in its tracks. And the Trousers of Time have a little bit of a moment. And the patrician sort of looks at it and says, and then leaves that there.
The air grows thick.
Yes. And there's that little moment and another one later on where Carrot sort of says all of these things about, you know, he's got a birthmark shaped like a crown and he's got this sword that he's had forever. And they sort of go, no, couldn't be anything like a king. That's not a kingly sword.
It's like the crown in Weird Sisters.
Yeah.
The actual magical object just looks like the essence of that object, not like a filigreed pretty one.
Not like the magical sword that once had made for this king that he's built.
Yeah, yeah. Not like bloody Kring throwback.
Fucking Kring.
Ugh, talking swords. No one likes them.
I didn't mind Kring.
I know, but you're wrong.
Yeah, that's fair.
We're only in one location.
We're still just in Ankh Morpork,
which is quite enough location for one dragon.
Yep, but I love the citizenry of Ankh Morpork I've put in here. Mm-hmm. Their mob mentality moment where they've basically got, they're all talking themselves into a dragon being king being a really good idea.
Yeah.
And immediately go to this sort of jingoism of like, right, well, you know, we can now burn the Clachin ambassador if we want. We can do whatever we like. We've got a dragon.
Yeah.
And it is this absolute determination that everything is fine. And also, let's be racist because we've got a dragon.
Yeah. It's part of the, let's take an opportunity to be bigoted, small-minded bastards. And partly like, we're in this horrible situation, so we're going to change the narrative to make it not a horrible situation or we can't deal with it.
Yeah. Like England and Brexit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Except we're all having a bit of a meltdown about that.
I haven't got an energy to have. I haven't got the energy to have a meltdown.
I feel like we should be having a meltdown about that because we're about to be in the grips of a horrendous recession and a huge cost of living increase as import starts becoming difficult.
Yes, but also global pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. So that's all going to be great.
So on to little bits we liked.
Yeah.
Dwarf bread made me smile. Dwarf cake.
Yeah, I was. Oh, do you know, I was looking into twice baked bread on the seashore. and I'm going to look into that properly for other books where we come back to dwarf bread as a fun little concept. But it's funny.
I'd like to say that I'm going to try and make some dwarf bread for the podcast. But what I mean is sometimes my bread goes very wrong and could be used in battle.
That happened when I accidentally put a tablespoon instead of a teaspoon of salt in my dough.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't rise. I was like, why didn't it rise? And Jack was like, the bread was delicious, but very salty. I was like, ah, there it is.
But it feels like it's a bit of a piss take of Lembas bread from Lord of the Rings, which is like this tiny, amazing thing that sustains them all day. And in this case, it sustains them all day because they don't want to eat it.
Yeah. I didn't get that. I loved that concept when I was reading the book, Lembas bread, I mean.
Yeah.
And it didn't make the connection.
Well, I had to interact with Lord of the Rings a lot to weigh various copies of it. So I had Lembas bread on the brain.
Osmosis.
Yes, I absorbed the concept of Lembas bread.
We'll talk about that next week, listeners.
Yes. That made me smile. And then on the following page from the Dwarf Gate, I think this has come up on the podcast before, the concept of nerd.
Which is when you're... Knerd.
Yes.
So as not to confuse it with us yelling nerd at each other.
The other side of the sobriety from drunk, which is apparently what Vimes is all the time and why he drinks, but he can't get the levels right.
Yeah. I don't know if this was like a particular reference to specific brain chemical things, but it's kind of reminiscent of various anxiety, depression, ADHD kind of things where you can't access the correct happy hormones without a little bit of chemical help. And so yes, a lot of people are more prone to alcoholism and things for that reason.
If you can't make your own serotonin, then store-bought is fine.
Exactly. Unfortunately, not available at Ankh-Morpork Pork.
Name of the thing.
Name of the thing in the thing. Yeah, no, it's. I know we like pointing that out sometimes. So it's page 247, once calls for the guards.
Guards!
That's all I have to say about that.
But what's excellent is on the next page, there's all of these guards and just Vimes, and they're looking at it going like, we can't. He's going to start swinging on chandeliers any minute. He's going to grab... And it's a reference to that dedication right at the beginning.
Oh, fuck, I've forgotten that.
Where he's dedicated the book to the palace guard, whose job is run in, attack the hero one at a time and be slaughtered. And this guard are aware enough of narrative causality to go...
Yeah. But
this doesn't look like it'll end well for us.
I liked what, of all things, Austin Powers did with that trope.
I have never seen an Austin Powers film all the way through.
Oh, that's a shame, because you'd hate it now. But
I hated
you'd have
it
loved
when
it when we were 17, and I'm never going to rewatch it now I know things about things. But I absolutely loved it as a kid, and it has, it has like the evil henchmen going in and getting slaughtered, but then kind of cuts to the loving wife finding out about her husband's death. All she knew is he was some minimum wage security guard, and oh, little Henry, your father's not coming home, and all of that.
I do like when things play with tropes like that, especially when the trope involves like lots of people getting sort of casually slaughtered. There's lots of silly things about things.
Oh, it's a fun trip.
Like stormtroopers going home to tiny stormtrooper families. And yeah. I know anyone who's a Star Wars fan who's listening, I know that's not how stormtroopers work. It's fine. You don't need to.
But also it kind of is now, because what?
Please don't tweet me about Star Wars, guys.
It's very, very important that you don't try and talk to us about Star Wars.
I don't have the emotional bandwidth.
I can't exaggerate how important this is.
Another little bit I liked... is we were talking about the patrician in prison and his trained rats.
He's
intelligent rats, including
Scrooge.
And he points out that they it may be linked to thalamic radiations from something near the Unseen University campus.
Sure.
And I partly like this because obviously it's cool that veterinary's done this, and because rats are cool and very intelligent, and I like rats. Listeners who have read further into the books and follow us on Twitter and have seen me get slightly stressed about the Pratchett World Cup will know that I have a favourite book, and this might be relevant.
You ended up taking it a bit more personally than I did in the end, which surprised me.
I really care about them. Anyway, listeners who have no idea what I'm talking about, that's fine. I'll move on. But intelligent rats, very cool.
Yeah, it's not a spoiler.
Intelligent rats come back.
Yeah.
Smart rats.
The last little bit is right at the end, which is nice. It's... Dibbler's anti-dragon cream, I think, came up in section 2. Is that the middle section?
Yes.
Yeah.
Genuine anti-dragon cream.
Made by monks in an ancient valley up in the mountains. And like, obviously not. It's some kind of cold cream he got, and he's selling it at 500% markup, isn't it? It's Dibbler. However, not this time. Because up towards the hub with the ram-top mountains and freezing peaks and lovely description that I'm not going to read all out of, a couple of yellow-robed monks are finishing the labelling of their box to CMOT Dibbler. You know, Lobsang, said one of them, one cannot help wondering what it is he does with this stuff.
Oh, that does bring me joy. Also, I like that there's a character called Lobsang, because we will experience that name again in the world of Pratchett.
I think it was also the monk's name in Good Omens. I think that's just... yellow-robed monk name in Terry Pratchett's head.
Yeah. All yellow-robed monks are Lobsang now.
That's probably problematic, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, probably. Fuck.
Never mind.
Sorry. Anyway.
Everything's cancelled again.
Yep.
Talking points.
On to the bigger stuff, yeah. This is just a fun running theme through this section, and this is the whole idea of million-to-one chances cropping up 9 times out of 10.
It's a million to one chance, but it just,
but it
might,
just
work.
Might work. And this starts with, this colon saying, look, when you need them most, million to one chances always crop up. and he's planning this shot. And of course they go into like, okay, so just shooting at the dragon isn't really a million to one chance. It's actually quite possible, but yeah. It just won't work. That doesn't work. So he ends up standing on one leg with soot on his face, his tongue sticking out, singing "The hedgehog can never be buggered at all." That's as much reenactment of that as we're getting on the podcast.
No more ukuleles, listeners. How do you feel?
I mean, as far as the audience know, I am actually standing on one leg, drawing a longbow with soot on my face, my tongue sticking out while singing. They
you
don't
are,
know.
Yeah.
I could
what,
be. Yeah, I totally
I
am.
See.
Yep.
It's nothing to do with my sleep deprivation. That's just what's happening.
Is it hallucinations or a bit? No one knows.
Am I hallucinating or just pleased to see you? What? Yeah, I like the idea of them trying to work out exactly what it would take in a completely non-mathematical way, but they've decided, yeah, no, this is it. This is exactly a million to one, yeah.
Well, I mean, there's some maths. Carrot tries to calculate the area of the dragon and then the area of the vulnerable spot.
Yeah, but then from there it goes downhill.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm not sure standing on one leg has much to do with mathematical probability.
I'm guessing the vulnerable spot obviously is another Smaug thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
Smaug. And the lucky arrow, I think, Bard in The Hobbit?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hits the vulnerable spot.
Yes. But also there's the double entendre of testicles.
Vulnerables.
Which is the only way I shall refer to I don't often have to refer to testicles in my day-to-day life.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, unless I'm threatening someone.
Threatening someone to keep them in the vulnerables doesn't have as much clout as balls.
Yeah. Also, it's very rare I'm threatening kicking. Normally there's a knife. Anyway... Gosh. I am a chef. I've got to keep up appearances, darling. Can't let them know I'm actually very soft and probably wouldn't stab them. I'm sorry, I don't think any of my colleagues listen to this. But yeah, to have that million to one chance not be a million to one chance and not coming through, and then the dragon flames it, and luckily the chances of surviving that explosion were exactly a million to one.
Yeah.
And that's what saves them. And of course, you know, eventually Colon's line to Vimes on the relationship between him and Sybil of it's a million to one chance, but it just might work.
Yeah, and it's almost like Colon being a fairy godmother then. He's like, he's trying to give them a bit of that magic.
It's really sweet. Yeah. Colon is surprisingly sweet, actually.
He is, yeah. I like Colon.
I do. I have a soft spot for him. They're also, when they're talking about Eril and the big dragon fighting, and... Vimes doesn't know about their whole plan and just says the chance of a dragon the size of Eril beating something that big are a million to one, and then there's this moment where they all pause and eventually and they all repeat a million to one, and then Colon just very calmly says, but it just might work.
Need to finish the phrase.
And they found this little magic in it and they've clung to it, and I think that's really lovely.
It is.
It makes me happy. So, yeah, I thought I'd do a positive talking point before we address the human condition.
Oh, God.
Should we talk about some character motivations?
Yeah, I just the kind of opposite progressions of Vimes and Wants were quite interesting. So at the start of the book, Vimes's motivations aren't really anything. They are moment to moment, almost. He's reacting to each thing as it goes along, and everything's horrible, to be honest, and just blah blah blah, just trying to survive each day and get through and not get his men killed and everything like that. But yeah. Then as the book progresses, he starts realizing that what he's trying to do is save the city, and he's doing detective work and sleuthing, and everything's becoming more organized in his mind. And eventually, I mean, it's not like him working everything out is what saved the city, but he did. He did it. Well done, Vimes.
He gains control of the situation, yes, in as much as he can.
That's a better way of putting it, yeah. Whereas Wants, on the other hand, starts off with all these evil machination motivations and organised, yes, doing Mr. Burns fingers on the other end of the camera. Well done, Joanna.
Yeah. I'm very gif-able today. Sorry.
Whereas Once is slowly becoming more unraveled as it becomes obvious that the dragon's mind is quite a lot better than his, and by the end of it he is, although he's coming off as quite organized and calm moment to moment trying to survive, and then even after the dragon's gone and he's in the palace, he's still you can tell every move he makes is just like, okay, I'll do this and then I'll be fine for another minute and then we can think about the next bit, and then it's just always one step behind almost. And
yeah, yeah, he's playing catch up with himself and he has completely lost control of the situation.
Yeah. And
that's a really interesting thing. I hadn't really thought about it like that.
It kind of came together for me just in that last scene when Vimes was all together for almost the first time in the book, and then Wants was just so clearly trying to get on top of what was happening.
Which, yeah, I mean, the whole Wants death scene was really odd because it was like very much, okay, we are going to, Vimes even defying Vetinari and saying, no, we're going to do this by the book and we're going to arrest him. But yeah, then he says, throw the book at him, and he dies. And
Vimes like, all right.
Yeah. Death is very weird in the Pratchett books. Like, sometimes it's a huge moment and sometimes it can almost be throwaway of just sort of a, oh, well, I suppose he is dead now. And that's kind of what we wanted anyway.
Yeah, I do wonder why Pratchett made that decision.
I would have liked to have, no, I mean, what I would have liked was for Carrot to wrestle with that a bit more, because Carrot, it happens because Carrot is quite sweet and innocent and didn't understand the metaphor. But what happens is that Carrot effectively murders someone.
He didn't mean to kill him.
No.
But he doesn't seem to mind that he did.
Exactly. And some of that's to do with just, we're at the end of the book and it wraps things up very tidily. And I think it is about wrapping things up tidily, because if you leave once in a prison cell, then...
I think later on, Pratchett becomes more comfortable with finishing a book with things still to be done on the admin side of things. Like,
yeah,
being a bit more realistic about how things actually end and how they don't really once the action's over. Yeah. But I think you're probably right. I think he was just wrapping it up.
Yeah.
Speaking of almost, the moment of realization that Vimes has on page 238, so quite a way in. We almost mentioned this the other week, but I cut it out because spoilers.
Was this the running?
Just in case any of you are reading it a section at a time, I do want to preserve your spoilers. Where is it? Here it is. And there's Vimes staring at nothing. Think of a running man, and further back in the fuddled mists of his life, a boy running to keep up. And under his breath, he said, any of them get out? So at this point, he's putting it all together and working out that Wants is the... I've forgotten his KKK title.
The,
you know what I mean?
Grand Supreme Master, Wizard Extraordinaire.
Dragon, yeah. Oh, no, he can't be. Yeah. Wizard Extraordinaire. I like that. And as we were saying and stopped ourselves, I don't know when you're meant to have worked it out, whether you're meant to be like, oh, Vimes was a bit slow on the uptake of this, or whether, because it's obvious when you've already read the book so many times, and I can't think back to the first time I read this.
No, absolutely not. I don't remember when I realised the plot twist.
Because I like all the little bits of foreshadowing in there. And like, I know we realise before Vimes does, because it just becomes apparent, but I'm not sure exactly when we're meant to work it out and then it becomes confirmed. It's nice to see Vimes come to the same conclusion like that. I don't know when we're meant to.
It's the kind of procedural thriller parody aspect of the book.
Yeah.
It's very much, and it's done very well.
That's it. And it's done well in all the Watch books, I think. You know, it's possible that this is the least clever of the bunch in that respect.
We'll have to wait
because
till we
they're
the
very intricate plots generally. Whereas this obviously followed a narrative for the reason that that's what it was doing. That's what it's parodying.
Yeah.
But I like a good detective novel. It's not the genre I go to time and time again, but I've got a few authors I really love, Ian Rankin being the best.
I've never
really enjoy crime novels.
I've never really been into crime novels or procedurals or thrillers and things, but I will sometimes sort of pick one up if like that's the book handy, and then I always find myself enjoying them.
Yeah.
But they're not something I actively seek out.
Yeah, for sure.
They don't have enough dragons in normally, so I like this one.
But Vimes especially actually reminds me of Ian Rankin's main character, Inspector Rebus, who's also a angry drunk to start with.
Yeah.
Although possibly doesn't have as much character development in a shorter time as Vimes does. Look at Vimes by the end of this reasonably short book. Look at him. All sentences and growing up.
But that once moment is quite, it's really good for seeing Vimes's character. It's not just seeing him work it out. It's the thing he clings to on it, and where a lot of his anger at once comes from is anyone get out.
Yeah.
Because he's once is so directly responsible for those deaths, the deaths of the rest of the elucidated brethren.
Yeah. And, at this point, has the near miss with the guard already happened, where Vimes thinks they've been flamed?
No.
It's not, has it? That's a bit later, yeah. So that almost, later on, he'll be even more mad about that, I think, because when he thinks his guys have almost died, he can't just calmly go, oh, did anyone get out?
Yeah. It's,
And I feel like when once said, did any of them get out, it was more like, is anyone going to tell on me? Than...
Yeah, I don't think he wanted them to be alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Because how did Brother Fingers end up?
I think he just ran off. I don't think we ever find out what happens to Brother Fingers. So obviously once is evil. Should we talk about evil in general?
If you like, yeah.
So this is, I think, one of the best pages of Pratchett's writing. And this is Vecinari talking to Vimes and finding this insight into how Vimes sees the world. You find life such a problem because you think there are the good people and the bad people. And you're wrong, of course. There are always and only the bad people, but some of them are on opposite sides. A great rolling sea of evil, shallower in some places, but so much deeper in others. But people like you put together little rafts of rules and vaguely good intentions and say, this is the opposite. This will triumph in the end. And amazing.
It's so patronising.
It is, but I
not with meaning to be patronising. It's just that he genuinely sees normal people as interesting specimens, and especially Vimes, who's not a normal person exactly, but is much closer to that sea of humanity, and yet manages to.
It's patronising, but I think Vecinari in this book almost finds some joy and amazement in it. It does fascinating.
Yes,
that Vimes can think like that. Sorry, do you want to read out a section of it as well?
Yeah, no, it's the bit that made me laugh so much. I went back and read it, the whole thing out loud to Jack the other week. It was just the end of the rant, which is Vimes going, well, they're just people. They're just doing what people do, sir. Lord Veterinary gave him a friendly smile. Of course, he said. You'd have to believe that. I appreciate it. Otherwise, you'd go quite mad. Otherwise, you'd think you're standing on a feather-thin bridge over the vaults of hell. Otherwise, existence would be a dark agony, and the only hope would be that there is no life after death. I quite understand. It's again just the, oh no, yes, no, I understand why you feel the need to not be quite so pessimistic about humanity. Of course you're wrong, but I do understand, old chap.
It's a beautiful page of writing, though, and it's these two really, really opposing philosophies. And it's what we've talked about with Vimes the whole way through this book, is that he believes enough in the city and its people to be disappointed by it, which he is on a very regular basis.
Yeah.
Whereas Vecinari comes from the standpoint of, right, everyone's a bastard, and honestly, bastards are necessary.
And it's Vecinari is almost the embodiment of that trite pessimistic phrase, which is, if you're a pessimist, then you're never disappointed.
Mm.
And so Vecinari, can, from his... From that perspective, he doesn't have to get emotional about it. He knows everybody's terrible, and so he can use all of his mental energy working out how to channel that terribleness into a way that works efficiently, at least. Whereas Vimes is constantly in turmoil because his view of the world doesn't match up with what is happening.
Yeah. Well, as Vecinari points out, it's that you need the bad people to work. The only things good people are good at is overthrowing the bad people, and they are good at it, but then once the tyrant's been deposed, who's taking the bins out? And that's the bit that the good people don't do. I'm not saying I particularly agree with that or don't agree with that. I think it's a really interesting philosophy.
Yeah, I think what he's saying is the tyrant was the one making other people take out the trash. And the good person doesn't know how to force people to do that. And it turns out he can't persuade people to do that because people are shit.
Yeah.
Which is a theme that's explored more in more of a show don't tell way later on, I think. But just is, I feel like this must have been incredibly cathartic for Terry Pratchett to write. Well, you get the idea, this all came out at once and you went...
Sometimes you really do just feel like everyone is an absolute bastard.
Yeah, I come down on Bettinari's side of things more often than on Vimes's.
Very much so. But it's so easy to come down on either side if you just look at the world. Like, if I scroll through Twitter for 5 minutes, I could come out of it absolutely hating everyone that has ever existed, ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about my personal Twitter there. But if I scroll through the podcast Twitter account, especially the notifications, then generally what I'm seeing is a lot of people really being quite lovely.
Yes.
And I could... The absolute dregs and the absolute best of humanity are all very... I'm trying extra hard to be optimistic at the moment. I think I do come down more on Vimes' side, that I think everyone has as much good in them as they do evil.
Yeah, if you look at it from a philosophy point of view, I think I'm thinking Plato, certainly, probably some others who kind of put humanity together out of non-emotional parts, almost like this motivation, that motivation, and the other motivation. And I feel like that's what Vimes thinks in a simpler way, that people are people. People are this, that, and the other, and sometimes it comes out this way, sometimes the other.
Yeah.
Whereas Bettinari's almost a more religious point of view, in that you have to believe in good to believe in evil, in the same way that you have to believe in God to believe in Satan. So
it really fascinates me, because it's an amazing page of writing. He says, you know, down there are people who will follow any dragon, worship any god, and ignore any iniquity, all out of a kind of humdrum everyday badness, a sort of mass-produced darkness of the soul. They accept evil not because they say yes, but because they don't say no. And that's I really agree with.
Yeah.
And that's something that Pratchett really comes back to in a great way. There's it's not a spoiler to say, there's a really good line in a later book, which is, evil begins when you start treating people as things.
Yeah. I think one could argue that this low-grade evil of the everyday person stems from fear rather than evil.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument to be made that it stems from fear, selfishness, or a combination of the two. Because obviously, I'm not sure, evil in itself isn't really a thing, which is the...
Yeah, I mean, without going into some like massive in-depth philosophical deconstruction of the concept of evil, because I haven't
eaten. Not on a Friday night.
I haven't eaten and I've got to go and finish making a cake. But
after the cake, then the deconstruction of evil.
What Bettinari describes as evil, I don't think is really evil. I think it is, as Vimes said, I think it's people being people. And yeah, people are inherently selfish. What one could describe as goodness is really people overcoming selfishness. We've had conversations before about, is it possible to ever be motivated by anything other than selfishness? Is there not some inherent selfishness in every apparently selfless act?
Yeah. And I try not to think about that too closely, because I think I believe, no, there isn't a way. And then I start hating myself for even the good things I do.
Mate, tell me about it. I'm in the middle of theoretically quite a selfless act at the moment, but
yeah,
I keep looking at, what am I gaining from this? Am I somehow still being selfish?
Yeah.
I don't really have a lot more to say about it. It really fascinates me. I think it's an amazing piece of writing. And I think the fact that deep, quick glare into the absolute soul of human condition, that it can come at the end of a parody police procedural with a dragon in it. That's what I love so much about these books, is that is there.
Yeah. And I think it's the most open look we get into Bettinari's brain. I think from here, usually, although his philosophy is apparent, it's not spelled out over two pages. And it's a really interesting character introduction at the end of a book as well.
Yeah, considering this is technically the second book that he's been in.
Yeah.
And this is right at the end of the book. We've watched Vettinari's actions for two entire books. Admittedly, he was a lizard for most of one of them.
Yeah.
Before landing on this philosophy. And also the difference, that balance between Vettinari and Vimes, It's the same way earlier on where Vimes is trying to chip his way out of the cell. Vimes didn't tell him he had a... Vesinari didn't tell Vimes that actually there's a key in here.
Yeah.
Because he needs to preserve Vimes' worldview. As much as Vesinari stands here and says, you are fucked up because you think people are good and they're not, they're all bastards.
Yeah.
He, as much as admits, he needs Vimes.
He doesn't push him too far with that.
Yeah. He needs Vimes to think like that because that's what makes Vimes work, and Vimes is this integral cog to the... in Vesinari's brain now to the functioning of the city.
Yeah. The actually the very, very end of this passage is Vimes pausing at the door and saying, do you believe all that, sir, about the endless evil and sheer blackness? Indeed, indeed, said the patrician. It's the only logical conclusion. But you get out of bed every morning, sir? Yes. I'd just like to know why. Why do you think? Why do you think he gets out of bed every morning with that?
I think Vesinari is so intelligent, and this is I don't know, this might sound arrogant, I think I'm quite clever.
You are quite clever, yes.
And because I'm quite clever, I am very easily bored. And I think Vesinari gets out of bed every morning as a challenge. It's the same way, like, if you look at Vesinari's motivation for being a tyrant and ruling Ankh-Morpork,
yeah,
like, if you actually think about it, he doesn't need to, but it's almost like he's gone,
he can get rich in almost any way he wanted. Yeah.
But it's like he's almost gone, I need something to keep me occupied. Making this city work will amuse me.
Best and, game of The Sims ever.
Yeah, but also I can't look at this thing that could work and doesn't and not make it work. It's almost like a very focused version of a character we'll get later on.
Yeah.
Who, you know, he looks at this and he goes, okay, well, I can make it better. So of course I'm going to do that. And that's why when you put him down into a tiny society like the rats and the snakes, he goes, okay, well, I can make this work better. Yeah. I can't be around it and not. And I think that is genuinely
fine for a couple of weeks.
Vesinari's getting out of bed in the morning is, I don't want to get bored, and I can't look at something that doesn't work and not try and make it work.
Yeah, and it also, it doesn't feel like he minds that everybody is evil. He just accepts that in the same way that, you know, we accept gravity. Whereas Vimes finds that concept very abhorrent.
Yes, gravity. He does like to float.
Yes. I'm sure he wouldn't like it if he heard about gravity, to be honest.
Oh, he'd be furious.
Like, oh, bloody we don't get a say about it. Fucking laws of physics. Who made those laws? I haven't got them in my book. But,
but yeah.
We obey the laws of thermodynamics in this city. We do not.
No, we absolutely do not. That was kind of a theme of the book, is that the dragon does not know the laws of physics or thermodynamics.
Yeah, I think that's probably as far as I can go looking at the nature of evil on a Friday night.
Yeah,
I'm sure we'll come back to it on another Vimes book.
Yeah, I think definitely we can discuss the philosophical nature of evil some more.
Yeah.
I like saying that. It makes me sound intellectual. Do you have an obscure reference, Finial, for me, Francine?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, most references in here, unless I've missed some really obscure ones, are still movie ones. So I'm like, whatever. But the one about the cockerel being arrested for crying on Soul Cake Thursday, which becomes Soul Cake Tuesday later on.
Yeah, retcon.
There's like a few cases of animals being arrested and killed for various reasons. But I found one about a cockerel. 1474, Switzerland. A cockerel-laden egg, which was considered a heinous and unnatural crime, and was condemned to be burned alive. And so was burned alive. It. Yes.
So they roasted it and ate it.
And it was apparently treated as seriously as the execution of a human heretic. I'm not quite sure how one could tell that in the that far back, but I suppose it was put in the books with everything else. But yeah. At Basel, Switzerland. Weird ass history with chickens.
Cool. Yeah, I'm assuming it was actually just a chicken and they'd got a bit confused.
Yeah, or somebody had put an egg up its bum and made him lay it. Apparently that was done as a prank occasionally on farms. So.
Of course it was.
People are weird, yeah.
All right, on that note, before I properly say goodbye to us all, tiny moment of admin. So that ends our discussion of guards. Next week, we've hinted at this, we've said things. There is a special bonus episode coming.
Yay.
All I'm going to say is that it comes out on the 30th of July. And if you know what else is coming out on the 30th of July, you might put one and one together and make a Lego brick. Sorry, I've just been measuring Lego bricks.
Good, good.
So, yeah, after that, we are going to take a little break and probably abandon your luggles during August. This is for a variety of reasons. We may end up reappearing. We don't know.
Yeah. Assume we won't be around during August.
We may return with a bit of Eric near the end of the month. We're not sure yet.
Yeah. However, do continue to contact us, sending us whatever's.
Joanna, we will
go through the contact details, and we'll be around. We just won't.
We
be
will absolutely
our
still be on the internet. We just won't be.
Yeah.
We just won't be recording. But before we go, again, I want to say a massive thank you to our listeners, because you're really lovely. And we worked out earlier, we've been making this for about a year now. We didn't actually start releasing episodes in October last year, because after we recorded our first episodes, my life caught fire.
Yeah.
And it turns out that fire has actually continued for 12 months.
Not diligent enough with that fire extinguisher.
No. So it is really nice to know that we have a lovely group of people out there who listen to us every week and send us their thoughts and queries and things. We're very grateful for you, and we will be back with you soon.
We are and we will.
Yes. However, in the meantime, dear listener, you can follow us on Instagram at The Tree Shall Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod. You can find us on Facebook at The Tree Shall Make You Fret, and you can email us your thoughts, queries, castles, albatrosses, and snacks at thetreeshallmakeyoufretpod@gmail.com. Mm. And in the meantime, dear listener, perhaps the magic would last. Perhaps it wouldn't. But then, what does? Ah, there's a puppy. Hello, puppy.
Hi.